This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jonathan Haas, is a soloist on an instrument that's usually relegated to a supporting role, the timpani, a.k.a. the kettle drums. He's rediscovered forgotten classical and jazz compositions for timpani and has commissioned and premiered new works by Philip Glass and Karlheinz Stockhausen. He also has his own jazz band and is the principal timpanist in the New York Chamber Symphony, the Aspen Chamber Orchestra, and the EOS Ensemble. He's the principal percussionist of the American Symphony Orchestra. If this hasn't convinced you of his versatility, consider that he's also recorded with the heavy metal bands Aerosmith and Black Sabbath. Let's start with a track from his jazz recording Johnny H. and the Prisoners of Swing. This is the Duke Ellington composition, The Twitch. It was arranged by xylophonist Ian Finkel, who plays in the band and co-produced the CD with Haas. Duke Ellington composition, The Twitch, with my guest Jonathan Haas on timpani. Jonathan Haas, welcome to Fresh Air. Would you describe the timpani set that you use on that track?
Well, the timpani are usually found in the back of the orchestra, but in the Twitch with my jazz ensemble, Johnny H. and the Prisoners of Swing, they're out in the front playing with all the standard jazz instruments. So in this recording, I used 8 timpani.
Now, I know you're trying to expand the timpani repertoire. What are the typical parts that the timpani are used for in classical music and in film scores?
Well, the best description of the timpani is the second conductor. That's what my teacher, Sol Goodman, used to describe our job as. And not only are we keeping the time for the orchestra, but the pitch that the instrument produces is very important to both to the melody and to the harmonies in any orchestral piece. The timpani is a very low instrument. It's amongst the lowest pitched in the orchestra. And it's looked over because of that, sort of, I like to call them the low boys. And it's like the heartbeat. I mean, you have to have a heartbeat to stay alive, so symphonic pieces need the timpani. And since we're in the back, we're not as visible as other instruments would be. We certainly are there and serving an important role.
What are some of your favorite pieces that are kind of familiar pieces that use a lot of timpani?
Well, I think the most famous timpani piece is the Zarathustra, the Strauss, because we heard it in 2001. It was the opening of with the C and the G going bum, 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 bum. And then everybody recognized the instrument. Probably my favorite piece is either The Rite of Spring by Igor Stravinsky, and then the Mahler Symphonies, of course, are some of the greatest timpani parts ever written.
Now, you have a classical CD, and one of the compositions on it is by Johann Fischer, who was an 18th century musician, and you play his symphony for 8 timpani and orchestra. Tell us a little bit about this piece and how it was rediscovered.
Well, that's how it all started. I was in a music library just going through catalogs of pieces, and I stumbled upon George Krushetsky, who's considered sort of the Hungarian Haydn, if you would. And there was a piece at the Lincoln Center Library for the Performing Arts in which was noted a concerto for 8 timpani and orchestra. And that began a whole series of phone calls and letters written to Budapest. And I finally found the pieces. There's actually a number of them. One is a partita for 6 timpani and orchestra, the Krushetsky Concerto for Oboe, 8 timpani and orchestra, and then Johann Fischer also wrote a piece for 8 timpani and orchestra. So at that point, I decided not only to find the pieces, make editions of them, then, of course, we had to make a recording of it because people wouldn't believe it.
And what would you say about how Fischer uses timpani in this piece?
The timpani are used as a melodic instrument. That's why there's 8 of them. And that was the intrigue, and that was the allure for me, because timpani is, I use it as a melodic instrument, not necessarily as a rhythmic instrument, although because it's percussion, you can't get away from that. But the timpani create a pitch. Each drum has a pitch. So if you have eight timpani, you have eight pitches, and that means the drummer can start playing melodies. And that was just the real kicker to do this, to have audiences see the drums, and then they discover that you're actually playing a melody that they can whistle to.
So you basically have a scale that you could play.
Exactly, have a scale.
Let's hear the opening of this Johann Fischer piece, Symphony for Eight Timpani and Orchestra. And you can hear the timpani playing the melody in part of this along with the rest of the orchestra.
That's right.
That's Jonathan Haas on timpani from his recording of 18th century concertos for timpani and orchestra. Jonathan, you were explaining that you used eight timpani in this recording, so you have a full scale. But what you don't have is all the accidentals, like you can't play any sharps or flats outside of what falls in a regular scale. Do you feel inhibited by that?
Well, since this was taking place in the 1700s, it certainly was groundbreaking, and it does sort of anchor me into the C major scale with certain minor keys that you can stray to, not many. So as a first try and as an historical event for the instrument, what it did is encouraged me to then find modern-day composers who then would write. They'd write in all the accidentals that the 17th century composers couldn't figure out how to do. And that's really as a result of the pedal mechanisms that now modern-day timpani have. We tune the timpani literally using our feet, very much like a harpist would. And this innovation really didn't exist in the 1700s. They used their what called our hand-tuned drums. So they had to use their hands to turn the turning knobs. There were about six of them on a timpani, and would take quite a while. So you couldn't change your pitches. Now we can play two octaves on one drum in about a nanosecond.
Huh? Do you have to have a really good sense of pitch, a really good ear for pitch, to tune the timpani?
The timpani absolutely requires a great ear, as they would say. The way that I approach it is that if I can sing something, if I can sing a part that I have to play, then I know I'm going to be able to play it on the timpani. It's a singing type of instrument. Unlike a guitar that has different strets on it where you can see where you can place your fingers, because we're tuning with our feet, you have to really just rely totally on your ear to know if you're in tune or not. And the timpani tend to go out of tune, especially when you use calf timpani heads, because of weather and climactic changes that it can occur in a concert hall during a concert. So you're always putting your ear down to the timpani and tapping so that you can hear the pitch. A lot of people think that we're smelling the drums or kissing them worse, but we're really tuning them when we bend over and listen to them.
And you have to do that sometimes during a performance?
Oh, all the time. I mean, if you're playing a piece by Bartok, the music for strings, celeste, and percussion, you're retuning all of the time. And you're constantly making sure that you're in tune. And even while you're playing, you're actually hearing your tunefulness or tunelessness based on how you're doing in any particular time.
My guest is timpanist Jonathan Haas. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is timpanist Jonathan Haas. Like you said, in addition to trying to go back and rediscover early pieces that use timpani, you're trying to create a contemporary repertoire. You commissioned Philip Glass to write a piece for timpani. Why did you want Philip Glass to write something?
Well, I became enamored with his music a long time ago. I've followed all of his orchestral pieces, and then I was actually sitting in one of his films watching the Pow Quatsi, and it dawned on me that he was the melodic composer that would be perfect to write a timpani concerto. And at the same time, coincidentally, I'd heard of a piece that he'd written called Prelude to Endgame that was used for the play, for the Beckett play, and he had written it for timpani and double bass. And at the time, Philip still had his phone number in the local 802 union book, so I just called him up, and I introduced myself, asked if I could come over to his house, and he invited me. He gave me the score to the piece, and then I rearranged it so that the timpanist played half of the double bass part while the double bass played half of the timpani part. So that way I was playing melody besides just a rhythmic pattern. And then halfway through the piece, we switched back to the parts we're supposed to have. And when Philip heard this arrangement, he was thrilled. He enjoyed it. He thought it was very whimsical and fit very well in his composition. So that was sort of our beginning and our introduction to each other and my love of timpani and his understanding of how to write for the piece.
What does it take to commission Philip Glass?
Well, it took 10 years for me because the first time out, I didn't get the grants that I needed to get in order to finance it. And then the second attempt, 10 years later, Meet the Composer was very generous and helpful in creating a fund and a granting for this concerto. And it also takes a certain amount of just stick-to-itiveness. My career as a timpanist, as you can probably imagine, has been wrought with lots of people telling me what I can't do, shouldn't do, and what won't be possible to do. And although I've taken everybody's word with great respect, I really ignored it all, because if that had been the case, I would have never done this to begin with. So it's sort of one of these against all odds, and when people said, well, you're going to be turned down, and a timpani concerto isn't something that's going to really interest grant-giving organizations, I had to stick it out. I had to wait it out and be patient.
There's actually, the Glass Symphony is actually for two timpanists, isn't it?
It's a double concerto, and the way that came about is that my very good friend and colleague, Catherine Cahill, who was at the New York Philharmonic at the time, had recommended to me that if I was going to commission a concerto, that I ought to do it as a double concerto. In other words, I play the concerto with the timpanist of the orchestra that I'm playing with. And the reason for that is that timpanists really don't get an opportunity as a soloist to play in front of the orchestra. So it was her feeling, and I thought she was right on with this, is that I'd have much more opportunities if I invited the timpanist of the orchestra that I was playing with to join me. And surely it has been it was a brilliant move, on top of which it gave Philip Glass the opportunity to write for twice the number of timpani that we originally had planned on. I play my part with seven timpani, and the other timpanist plays with seven. So that's 14 timpani, but it's not 14 notes because we have pedals now. So we have access to, any note and every note that even a concert pianist would have. And that's why the concerto has the complexity and the depth that it has.
So let's hear the beginning of the piece that you commissioned from Philip Glass, the Concerto Fantasy for Two Timpanists and Orchestra. And my guest is timpanist Jonathan Haas. The beginning of Philip Glass's Concerto Fantasy for Two Timpanists and Orchestra. This piece was commissioned by one of the timpanists, my guest, Jonathan Haas. This recording has not yet been released commercially. Is there anything you do in this piece that you hadn't done before?
Well, just about everything, starting from being in front of the orchestra as a soloist. It was one of the experiences that I wanted to have as a timpani soloist that I hadn't had to date, except for playing the 17th century timpani concertos, which was a lot of fun and was the inspiration to continue on into the modern age. Besides that, the experiences include everything from having to be able to adjust to different concert halls with the type of timpani mallets you use, and because I've probably played with more orchestras now than different orchestras than any timpanist has in the history of music, 14 so far, that I've also had to learn how to adjust to different styles of the timpanist that I'm playing with my companion, as well as to fit into the sound of the orchestra, because I've played it now with everything from a chamber orchestra. Last week, I performed it with the Iris Chamber Orchestra in Memphis, and was a real adjustment from playing with the BBC in December with a huge orchestra. So there's been a lot of different experiences just in adjustment that have been very intriguing and a lot of fun to figure out.
Why did you want to specialize in timpani?
Well, I specialized in timpani first and foremost because I love the sound of the instrument. It's a very rarefied instrument. Unless you know what it sounds like and your ear is adjusted to it, you're not even sure many times that it's playing in a Mozart symphony or in a Haydn symphony, maybe even Beethoven. But I was drawn to it early in high school. I went to Neutrer High School in Winnetka, Illinois, and we had an orchestral program where I played through all the Beethoven symphonies by the time I was done with high school, and that means I played timpani parts. So I had a real knack for it out of high school. And as a solo instrument, it really is the only instrument that wasn't investigated fully in terms of its capability, its capacity, and in particular, its ability to thrill audiences. So it being a unique instrument, it was a perfect match for me. I loved the sound. I wanted to have a career as a soloist. There were marimba soloists becoming very active, percussion soloists, but I wanted to find my niche, which was on the timps.
Now, timpani they're kettle drums. They're really big, and they're probably pretty expensive, so it's not like you can rehearse at home in your little bedroom when you're growing up. So how did you go about having drums to even play with?
Well, they began as a combination of dining room table and instrument to practice on. When I was living in Manhattan, I had a studio apartment, and at the time I'd bought 4 Goodman timpani made by my teacher and put them in the apartment. And basically it was that and a sofa, and when I ate dinner, I put a board on top of the timpani, and that was the table. They are heavy, and they're real big. In fact, I'm building one now that's going to be 70 inches in diameter. I'm building the world's largest timpani. Many people ask me why, and it's sort of like, why would one climb Mount Everest? Well, if you're a timpanist, then you should build a 70-inch timpani and see what it sounds like. But that's just, that goes with the territory. Now I have a very successful percussion rental company, and there's very experienced people who pack my instruments and ship them all over the world, actually. And it's actually because it's just a well-oiled machine, but a heavy one.
Jonathan Haas is the principal timpanist in the New York Chamber Symphony and the Aspen Chamber Orchestra. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with timpanist Jonathan Haas. He's a soloist who's performed with many orchestras and is the principal timpanist with the New York Chamber Symphony and the Aspen Chamber Orchestra. He's commissioned and premiered works by Philip Glass and Karlheinz Stockhausen and has performed with the heavy metal bands Aerosmith and Black Sabbath. He also has a jazz band. He thinks of timpani as a solo instrument. When you're playing with an orchestra and you're not doing the pieces that are for timpani, but the timpani is just kind of a part of the piece, do you have to wait a long time for your few measures?
There's a lot of sitting around, and actually that sitting around time was time that I devoted to thinking about things like commissioning Philip Glass.
Right.
So, you sit around a lot, and sometimes you read a book. Other times we're talking to our friends in the orchestra and getting in trouble in the back. I mean, that goes back to high school.
So, like, during a rehearsal, you might just be reading a book, even though you're in with the orchestra, but you have, like, 10 minutes of sitting out maybe before your part?
Oh, yes. Most timpanists are very well read.
Right. Now, when you were growing up, were you just listening to classical music, or were you also listening to whatever the pop music of the day was?
Well, I'm really mostly interested in rock and roll. That's where I came from in high school. Besides playing this wonderful orchestra, really was in rock bands. I would say the majority of percussionists, timpanists in the United States who were growing up in the late 50s and 60s, were in some sort of rock band or possibly a jazz band.
Yeah, but there aren't timpani in your average garage band.
Well, Ginger Baker made the timpani as famous as can be in White Room, and when I heard him playing timpani on those tracks in White Room, I was hooked on both styles of instrument from then on.
So did you play timpani in your own rock band?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't miss having that opportunity. It's something I'd like to do actually more is to play more rock and roll, and maybe with the 70-inch timpani that I'm building, it's the perfect vehicle to form a rock band around.
And I've read that you played with Aerosmith and Black Sabbath. What was the context for that?
Well, I was the timpanist on some recordings, Armageddon. There's a nice little timpani part in the background, and I'm a member of the orchestra playing on those tracks. And my rock and roll experience goes back to Emerson, Lake & Palmer, who went on tour in 1979. We were supposed to go on a world tour, but because of the economy and some lighting poles that fell down on our first gigs, we went out for about 2 months, and I was the percussionist and timpanist with Emerson, Lake & Palmer. So I got a really good taste of playing in arenas with 30,000 people screaming and yelling and just having a ball, and having a timpani mic'd up to about a trillion decibels. And just had a ball doing it.
Where do you rehearse now?
Well, for the concerto, I have a studio built in the basement of my house, and I've had it soundproof so that my family doesn't have migraine headaches all day long. And at this point, I've played it enough where I don't practice it a lot. I don't need to because I remember it. But I have a studio in my house. I used to have a place. When I was going to school, down on 8th Avenue, it was called the Music Building, and it's still there. It's on 8th Avenue and 38th Street. And I remember I would come back late at night with my concert tails on from Carnegie Hall and with 5-6 timpani, and in the middle of this neighborhood that's, for a better way to characterize it, it's very colorful, carrying my timpani up these stairs up to a little tiny rehearsal room up in the music building, which was basically filled with heavy metal bands.
Hmm. It sounds like being a timpanist is actually a pretty expensive affair, especially if you want to, like, have drums made and have drums shipped and soundproof your basement.
Being a timpanist is a labor of love, without a doubt. The instruments, they're large and they are expensive. But like anything, it's all within context. I certainly wouldn't compare myself to somebody who has to buy a Stradivarius violin. We're not in that price range. And that, in essence, any musical instrument that you fall in love with, that you become an advocate for, all of those sorts of things, how big they are and how expensive they are, become really very trivial in comparison to the music that you want to make with them.
Well, I want to play something else from your jazz recording with your band Johnny H. and the Prisoners of Swing. And this is an excerpt of a suite you put together of music for timpani that was written to feature Vic Burton in the 1920s. Who was he?
Well, Vic Burton is one of my role models. I met his brother, actually, who's still alive in the New York area. And Vic Burton was a very well-known percussionist, a jazz percussionist, as well as a studio player. And he was playing with Red Nichols and the Five Pennies. And at a recording session in the 1928 in Chicago, there were some old beat-up timpani sitting in the corner of a room in the studio. And Red Nichols suggested to Vic Burton that he play something on them. And he took them out, and they recorded a very spontaneous recording session, the very first jazz timpani parts that have ever been recorded or known to anybody that I know. And that was really, when I was introduced to Vic Burton's music, I was really hooked on a whole new genre in which the timpani can exist.
And were you able to find the transcriptions for this?
There were no transcriptions. They were improvising. So what I did is I took the recording, which had about 4 or 5 pieces on it, to Ian Finkel, who's a virtuoso xylophonist and also a fantastic arranger who lives in New York. And he basically took the recording and transcribed everything that Vic Burton was doing and then created a jazz ensemble and sort of gussied up the timpani parts, made them a little more complicated, made them a little bit more interesting to play. And that was really the beginning of Johnny H. and the Prisoners of Swing, thanks to Ian Finkel's great artistry.
Well, why don't we hear this this recording? And Jonathan Haas, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
This is Johnny H. and the Prisoners of Swing playing Delirium. Music from the CD Johnny H. and the Prisoners of Swing, featuring timpanist Jonathan Haas. This is Fresh Air.